Space communication. These will be among the main topics for dialogue.
Hey, Mattia, how you doing, brother?
Yo, Dan, very well. I mean, I must say, I would be better if I was in Bali next to you, but, you know, can't complain.
Yeah, well, here I am sitting under the palm tree, not trying to make you jealous. Well, you have a pretty nice plant behind you in a sheet of plastic.
Yeah, exactly. I can't complain. Outside is also beautiful, so, you know, I can't complain. It's all good.
Good stuff. And which part of the world are you in at the moment?
Right now, I'm just outside of Florence. So in the countryside, looking really, really beautiful. We had a lovely summer and yeah, trying to zoom out after a very busy year, traveling all over the place. Now I'm just kind of trying to reground in here before, you know, another busy year ahead.
Cool. Well, let's talk about plastic, eh?
Yeah, please. I do that all the time.
Now it's precious. It's estimated that there's 75 trillion pieces of microplastic in the ocean, which is just obviously horrific, staggering when you look at the data, the global crisis that's going on. And for us here at Space Available, our mission is very much to try and change the perception of waste. And we've been radically recycling for the past few years. Estimated we've recycled around 5.3 million pieces of single-use plastic in our products. And of course, we couldn't have done that without the precious plastic movement and your machines that very much provided us the tools to be able to do what we do. So for anybody that doesn't know about precious plastic, do you want to just give a bit of background, maybe into the movement, yourself, how you got started, and what you guys do?
Thanks, Dan. I think you're really continuing the work that we initiated like now 10 years ago, really, like to really show people and the world and society that plastic is precious and can be precious. And if we want to avoid more plastic to enter the oceans, we have to convince more people that this is actually a useful, potentially precious material that shouldn't be wasted. It shouldn't end up in the ocean because it's a waste of resources. It's that can just only result in problems for the environment and ecosystems and humans at large. So at Precious Plastic, we really see every single one of the 8 billion people out there a potential recycler. And we really want to empower everyone out there to start recycling themselves, to start to turn this plastic that is considered waste into something that is precious. And to do that, we give them the tools to do so. So we share open source drawings to create machines to recycle plastic. And we put them online so that anyone can replicate the machines just like yourself and start recycling plastic. And this is initiating, of course, you know, a whole process of discovery into this new material that up until a certain point you consider waste, and then you just see it as another material, just like you had wood or marble or other materials that people used to work with historically. Nowadays, we have abundance of this material, and we're just giving people the tools and the knowledge to work with that. So we have the machines, and on top of that, we also have the Precious Plastic Academy, which is a zero to hero journey for anyone that wants to start recycling. There we're going to be teaching you what plastic is, how it can be used, how it can be recycled, how you can build different machines to create different outputs, different techniques, different molds, all the way down to a series of business models that would enable you not only to start your DIY project, but to start your own recycling business so that we can have a movement of businesses that are dedicated 100% of their time to recycle plastic. So this way, we really think, you know, a decentralized bottom-up movement can have a go at tackling this huge problem that you just described in the beginning. I think I covered it. I mean, it's a very large project. Might have missed a few things, but hopefully in the conversation, it's going to come out.
No, that's great. So you guys are 10 years in. And what sparked the idea initially? Because it seems to me, I mean, I've been sort of actively looking into recycling now for, I would say, just under 10 years. Got interested in it just before I moved to Bali. And then when I moved to Bali, that's when I really got things going and I discovered precious plastic and we did various projects here. But you guys were obviously very much ahead of the curve because back a decade ago, not that many people were interested in recycling. nor was the plastic waste crisis really as well spoken about as it is today. So what kind of sparked the initial idea for you to do this project, and how did you kind of go about making the machines?
Yeah, so the project was originally started by our founder, Dave Atkins, during his graduation project. So it was simply just, you know, a university project. He wanted to sort of explore and research how you could work with this material. And of course, being someone that is very sort of sustainability oriented, and just, you know, I think our generation is kind of coming to the realization that quite a few things are fucking up. Quite a few things are just coming to a point where, you know, we can't just ignore them anymore. So, you know, when we think, you know, how do we spend our lives? How do we spend the time that we are given on this planet? You know, we might just want to focus on these problems. So I think that's what they did before any of us really, or like most of us back in 2012, 2013. And then he developed on this this project over the course of a year, developed a few machines, and then he released them as part of his graduation project, 10 years in 10 days. So on the 21st of October, 2013, Fresh Plastic version 1 was released. This was a very bare bone version, few machines, few drawings. He's not an engineer, he's just a designer. But the idea was there, and the core underlying pillar of Precious Plastic was there. The idea to share free and open source knowledge on how to replicate this machine. So he's made this machine, and he just simply put a website together, put the drawings in there. And, you know, surely enough, within a year, two people replicated these machines. And this was enough to sort of show the way to Dave. It's like, okay, this is very powerful. If you do it properly, way more people can actually, you know, share knowledge rather than machines and tools. And then, you know, take it onto themselves to tackle this problem together.
Well, cool. So it started off as a university project, which then he implemented in the real world. And how many people are using your machines? I know you can't obviously count everybody, but in terms of your community now, how many people do you estimate, or how many workshops, or how many individuals have made your machines now then, or recycling your community?
It's a really hard question. You know, as you can imagine, running an open source project makes it hard to track. You know, we have this website, we have, you know, all the knowledge, and we have the download kit, we have different how-tos. But anyone can go there, download the thing, just, you know, do their project, never come back. So it's kind of hard for us to sort of precisely say how many people are working on the project. Mm. We take as a measure our map, which currently has around 1,000 organizations that are proving that they have built the machines. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. Way more people are you know, working with the Precious Plastic machines around the world, but they probably don't even know about Precious Plastic, or they can't be bothered to get on the map. So the estimate is much larger. We just ran in 2023 an impact survey to try and understand a little bit better, you know, the numbers and how many people are working sort of on Precious Plastic. And for example, people reported that over 6,400 people are currently employed full time working on Precious Plastic. And when it comes to volunteers, we're looking at around 11,500 people volunteering in different projects, because sometimes these are still DIY projects. They are still maybe NGOs that want to clean up their environment. So realistically, you know, smaller budgets. But, you know, through the impact survey, which we had, you know, around 500 entries. So it's not even the full extent of the people that are on the map. So really just this is just gives you a glimpse of what's the actual impact on the ground. But I think, unfortunately, we're probably never going to know the real impact of the project.
But it's in the tens of thousands, I'm sure. I mean, I know hundreds of people now who are doing it, and people that are actually selling the machines, I know, are doing very well. Obviously, here in Bali, we have WeDo. There's several other people that I know who are now selling the machines, and they can't make them fast enough. So there's a lot of interest in it. So anybody listening in that's interested, they would go to the Precious Plastic website, they would download the plans. Of the drawings for the machines. They would then build the machines, which aren't that difficult to build. They're not like super high tech, right? They're pretty manageable for anybody that's handy or it's kind of basic engineering. And then in Indonesia, for us, the plastic waste crisis is just evident. It's everywhere. There's trash pickers. You can just literally scavenge. It's very visible in the streets, in the ocean, in the rivers. Whereas maybe in other places, it's a little bit less visible. It's maybe a little bit more hidden. how does somebody go about collecting the waste plastic? So let's say they build the machines, you know, they build it in their garage at home, they can recycle what they use, but maybe that isn't enough. Like, where do people generally find the waste plastic from?
Yeah, it's a very good point. In a way, plastic being so global, it's really serving all of these different users, if you want. So we noticed that more like in Western societies, in Europe, in the US, definitely the approach is more, I would say, on education / R&D. Some design studios, they use it. So it's the volumes are much smaller, right? You're looking at more, not much, aiming at recycling big chunks of plastic, because realistically it gets collected and sorted pretty properly, I would say. So I would say their focus is more, education, R&D, one-off projects. Mm. And in their case, I would say most of the plastic it's collected from either post-industrial. So, I'm a big company, I'm making toothbrushes, whatever. I change the color of the toothbrush. I'm going to have 10,000 prints that I need to throw away because the color, I need to make sure that the machine is clean. And usually this plastic gets sent to landfill, right? So if you make those connections, you can very easily access high quality material that would otherwise go to the dump site. Otherwise, we actually just released a very powerful collaboration, we believe, yesterday with Prusa Research Lab. This is one of the biggest 3D printing company out there. They make over 10,000 3D printers every month. And we just want to connect our two communities because they have a lot of 3D printing waste that naturally gets generated through 3D printing. And, we are often in need of sort of cleaner plastic to work with fresh plastic machines. Because, of course, as you know, you can recycle plastic from the ocean, but it's a big headache. Whereas, for our community, if you can find sort of cleaner sources of plastic, you're going to make your life a little bit easier. So we're trying to make this collaboration and this connection between the two communities so that we can sort of, plastic that is a problem for the community can become a resource for another. Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting how in Asia, there's a lot more almost kind of micro, like mini manufacturing going on. Whereas in Europe, it seems to be more workshop driven, R&D driven, community based.
University.
That's because in the slightly more developing countries, it's a lot easier to access like landfills, or there's lots of people making money from scavenging waste from the streets. Or right now in Bali, we have Sungai Watch, who are collecting plastic from all of the rivers. They literally started at the end of my road here. That was their first barrier. And they're collecting tons and tons of plastic every single day. It's like phenomenal what they're doing. Whereas if that was in London, that would be the council's job. They wouldn't, I don't think they would just let, a few young kids put these trash barriers in all the rivers in London. They just wouldn't, you couldn't do it. Whereas in Asia, it's still very kind of loose and you can kind of get away with doing these sorts of things. And it tends to be
the better or the worse.
Companies, yeah. Either individuals or private companies pushing it forward with zero government support, no funding. It's very much kind of grassroots style. And it's what that's causing now is these great little kind of economy that's going on, kind of plastic waste economy, which is really thriving. I mean, we're part of that as well. There's now several workshops in Bali who are all doing very, very well and all around Indonesia using your machines. And so, yeah, it's become like really widespread and it's become kind of cool to buy things that are made from recycled plastic, and it's great because it starts a conversation and it's that's what you guys have always championed, that it's actually a precious material. It just has nowhere to go. And now you've supplied the machines, we do have, we can use our creativity, collaborate and make beautiful objects that, we can sell locally. I mean, we're selling stuff globally now. I mean, we're in everywhere from Selfridges to Mr. Porter to, kind of all over Japan, which is great because it does start the conversation. But we're in the kind of stage now where we're thinking, how do we kind of go hyper local and maybe work with local precious plastic sort of community members in different territories to kind of collaborate on things that we can sell in those specific territories. Mm-hmm. I think it's a way smarter way of doing it. But we've definitely seen the interest just in the last few years really excel at quite a big rate. I mean, when we first built the lab down at Potato Head, I think it was 2017, a few people were interested. It was, the plastic issues were sort of known about, but not that widely spoken of. Whereas, you know, fast forward 5 years or 5-6 years, it's like, it's everywhere in Bali now. It's like everyone's talking about it. It's a big thing, which is fantastic, you know. Have you noticed that the kind of interest generally is just really booming over the past couple of years?
Yeah, I would say last year I was in Bali visiting you and other people, and I was really blown away. I mean, you guys are really like at the forefront of what's going on, right? And I think also because of that lack of the state, right? The state is kind of missing in certain aspects, and that allows for human creativity and entrepreneurship, I guess. You know, that's where it's lacking, and the state, you know, people come in to fix their own issues, right? Their own problems. I think that's where you see a lot of really inspiring innovation. So I was very much blown away also by the sheer number of people that are working in there. I was coming again, looking at the map. There was maybe 30, 40 people working at like organizations working. I was like, wow, that's cool. Then I get there on the ground, I talk to people, and I'm like, wow, that's maybe 200-300 people, organizations working in Indonesia alone. So I was very amazed by them. And yeah, if I can just go back to the impact report that we ran to sort of back some of your thoughts there. So the 500 people that entered the survey, which are not the whole community, they reported generating $36 million US dollar in revenue last year alone. So, you know, small scale micro recycling is becoming a fully legit business for many people around the world. So that makes me hopeful, because, you know, once you have a bit of that business drive behind an idea, I think it can spread much faster, I would say. I think I'm missing the question though. Wait, you're asking, okay, the timing. Yeah, I would say precious plastic, because it was kind of early on, was very lucky to hit on the nail the timing, right? We released version 2. So we talked about version 1, 2013. A couple of people replicate. Then we won a small award. We hired an engineer, and then we put together a small team to improve version 1. And in March 2016, we released version 2. And the time was just ripe. People were starting to notice the problem of plastic waste was becoming too big to ignore. And people just wanted solutions. And there we are coming onto the global stage with this very applicable solution for basically anyone that is interested. So the time back then for us, the global level was perfect, right? And I think it was, you know, and it was still early, right? Because it was still, I would say, only sort of the more aware people, the more curious people, they were, you know, okay, well, what can we do, right? How can we fix this problem? And, you know, and since then, you guys on the ground have been applying all the knowledge that we developed, and we keep on developing on the ground. And right now, you guys are the ones spearheading the recycling, the development, and pushing forward the movement from the ground up, I would say. And that's what makes me, hopeful as well, because this is really becoming a movement, and you know, it can scale much, much faster if it's built bottom up, not top down.
Well, definitely. I mean, we've seen the interest grow like so much, just even the past sort of 2 years, I would say. There's so many like little workshops popping up, just interest in general, and people are just fascinated. I think people have got that connection, emotional connection with plastic, because, you know, we all use it. You can't avoid it really, you know, it's kind of impossible. I mean, some people do, they live a really hardcore zero waste lifestyle. But generally, in day-to-day life, it's kind of difficult to avoid it, you know. And I think it makes people feel a bit guilty. They're like, oh, you know, I've ended up at the supermarket, there's tons of plastic here. Then even in the recycling bin, you know that it's not getting recycled. I mean, in the UK and in America, they just send it off to Asia, it gets landfilled, it gets recycled in landfills. People are unearthing that here in Indonesia now. It's they're kind of digging out, and it's all American brands that don't operate in Indonesia, so it's all getting shipped over. So I think people feel like they want to do something, but they just kind of don't know where to turn to. So they're now looking at these little sort of more micro workshops, you know, precious plastic organization community members, and really sort of like showing a lot of interest and getting behind it. And they're just fascinated. People want to learn. People want to get involved. And I mean, we've just seen it within our own business. It's definitely the kind of desire for people to get involved is there for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, don't get me wrong. I think I don't want to send out the message that this is the solution to the plastic waste problem. I mean, you know, the numbers are just too large, right? I mean, it's hard to just tackle that, you know, just on an individual level. I think, you know, we need to tackle that on multiple layers. And there needs to be that reduction in consumption. There needs to be legislation coming into place. And of course, there needs to be, you know, the small scale recycling movement that also contributes to, you know, alleviating the problem. But, you know, mm-hmm. alone, we're never going to fix this problem. It's just too big, right? Well, we need like a consortium of people.
Yeah, I feel like what it's doing is it's really starting a conversation, and it's really kind of shining a different light on the fact that this is not, there's no such thing as waste. It's just a material and we're just discarding it. Whereas if it was like this cup, which is, you know, a brass cup, a copper cup, sorry, you wouldn't just throw it away because it feels of value. Whereas if that was a, you know, plastic cup, people would just throw it away, or a plastic bottle. Whereas for us, it's a very high value material because we're going to make something really nice out of that. So it's kind of changing that perception of waste. And I think that's what our objects are doing. And that's what, you know, it makes people think a little bit different about it, starts the conversation, and that's when the ripple effect comes in. So we're not sort of claiming that recycling is the answer. Of course, the answer is consume less. Ideally, there'd be no, you know, there'd be no single-use plastic. We would eradicate that, and there'd be a much more sustainable alternative, whether it's a biomaterial or whatever. So we see this as being a very short-term solution to kind of get things moving. But we definitely know, we're not sort of saying, okay, this is the solution to everyone's, to the world's plastic waste crisis. Definitely not. But it's a start, you know. You've got to start somewhere, right? Yeah.
And I mean, if you think about that example of the cup, which, by the way, I wouldn't advise anyone to make from plastic because ideally you don't drink from plastic. but you could also think about the ripple effect there of someone that bought that cup from a small scale plastic recycling business, you know, of themselves being there and realizing the value of this plastic and potentially maybe reducing how much plastic they use because they're like, okay, this is actually, you know, a useful material and it takes a lot of resources to be recycled. But I would say the key there of, you know, what you were discussing, which resonates a lot with me, is it's really in the small scale element of what pressure plastic does, right? Because I think it's the same with ceramic and other materials, right? When it's mass produced somewhere off on the other side of the planet, naturally, you know, your connection to that product is lost, right? It's lost in the many thousands of miles that are in between you and the people that make, people rather machines that make your products. Whereas when it's made more small scale, when you buy your ceramic cup at the local store from the lady that made it, you know, with tons of love, naturally you build a connection to the product. And I think that's what our society misses nowadays, a connection to the products that surround us all the time, right? And I think what Pressure Plastic tries to do is to rebuild that connection, to rebuild those stories into the products, because that's how you can, you know, hope for the products to last a little longer when their owners, they have sort of, a direct connection with the product, and they're not just going to discard it after 6 months because now they like red or something. So that's, you know, that human connection and story, I think, is crucial to tackle this problem.
Yeah, I think it's just that throwaway culture, you know, that kind of instant culture that we're living in, where it's like fast, drink it once, throw it away. Don't worry, there's millions more on the shelf. You know, it's cheap, it's accessible. I think that's like the issue, you know. It's kind of nothing is cherished anymore. It's kind of like, it's so fast paced. Whereas I remember my grandmother, who was like post-war, she would like keep her yogurt cartons, empty yogurt cartons in the cupboard, you know, because it was like, because I guess back in those days, if you had something, you cherished it. It wasn't like that culture, like pre-50s, that kind of single-use culture wasn't so kind of implemented, I would imagine. And I remember kind of collecting these little like single-use cups and really sort of, because you just didn't throw things away. That was just not what you did back in those days. Where it's obviously completely different today. Every household chucks away like 8 trash bins every week, and it, you know, it's not getting, there's no circular system for it to go in. And I was reading a study a while back that was suggesting that the amount of plastic that's being produced ever in the world is already enough to keep us going forever if it was in a circular system. So we would never ever have to even make any new plastic. If we could somehow control this, get it into a circular system, you know, reuse it, recycle it, and just keep it going. So yeah, it's just scary when you see the numbers of how, you know, how much plastic there is out there, and we don't know where most of it is. It's either in the ground, it's in a river, it's in our bodies. It's we've absorbed it now. I'm breathing it in. We're both breathing it in now without realizing it. Yeah. It's in clothing. It's in our water we're drinking. It's in the fish that we're eating. You know, they say it's a credit card size of plastic we're consuming every week, which seems hard to imagine, but according to the data, that's what we're doing. And over time, it's like a wheelie bin worth of plastic that we consume in our bodies, which is just insane to think about. So pretty scary, because we don't actually know how or what the long-term effects of that is going to be on ourselves. You know, like, is that causing cancer? We you know, is it having other issues, you know, health issues that we don't know about, other than just the environmental side? So yeah, we're obviously deeply connected to nature, and whatever we throw in nature, that generally it's going to come back at us in some way. And I think for me, that's the big problem. I think we've, as humanity, we've kind of disconnected from nature. It's like us as these individuals, and we just throw things away and think, okay, someone will deal with that. And of course, there's no such thing as a way. There is no way, right? It comes back to different places. So we kind of throw it away in a bin, and then we end up drinking it in the water. So it kind of goes back into the system. So yeah, for us, kind of like making space for nature, trying to reconnect with nature, it's a big part of like the message of what we're trying to push out there. And yeah, recycling is like obviously a small part of that, but it's an important part, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, I would totally agree. I mean, I think, but I do believe there's also, you know, this throwaway culture, it's kind of something that we are inheriting from this generation. I think our generation is starting to pretty rapidly wake up to, you know, the impossibility of continuing, you know, business as usual. It's just not going to happen. We cannot afford it, right? Even though there are big powers trying to push for continuing that, I think our generations are just kind of, you know, waking up to that and realizing that, you know, I can't go on this way much further, because yeah, our bodies, our societies, our children, and just nature at large and ecosystems at large cannot withstand that for much longer.
Mm. And for anybody that is currently using our machines, I'll just talk about my personal experience, because we work a lot with sheets. You know, we kind of use the sheet press, or sometimes the ovens. And one issue that we have is the sheets seem to be warping quite a bit, and that's like a bit of an ongoing issue. Do you have any advice on how we could kind of get perfectly flat sheets, or is there any? Yeah, I'd be interested to know if there's any kind of ways of solving that issue, because it's one sort of pain point that we have right now, where we're trying to, especially now we're doing things with interior architecture, and you need that precision, and then the tolerance on the sheets is kind of sometimes, you know, higher on one side, or it's warped slightly. Like, I don't know if that's just the technique that we're using, but do you have any kind of solutions to that?
Yeah, I would say Parish Plastic is very much inspired by the software movement or way of developing a project. So we work in versions, right? Each version, we have new advancements. And also the machines, they are in different versions, right? So the shredder that we developed in 2015, it's already gone through a couple of iterations, and it's become better every time. When it comes to the sheet press, we just put it out in 2020. So that's version one. A lot, you know, we put it out there. Usually we put it out there, we see how people take it on, we get feedback, and then we improve on the machine. So I would say there are a few things that are known issues. I would say tolerance is one, bubbles is another. And there are ways to improve that. I've actually made a whole video about it, which I might share with you later. From these guys in Costa Rica, the Recycled Studio. Really, really cool guys from London, actually. And they've hacked the sheet press slightly, putting like a big aluminium bar on top, on the bottom, I think 10 centimeters or something, so pretty thick. But that allows for, you know, less warping, and their sheets, they are top notch. A bit like Smile Plastic, you know, when you see these perfect sort of industrial sheets, they're at that level, right? That's, you know, virtually no tolerance. These guys are obsessing over the sheets, and there's also no bubbles whatsoever inside. So I think that could be one. I would say it's also how you apply pressure. They apply pressure not all at once, like slowly over time. So they have like a timer, and I think it's every 3 minutes they just pump it up a bit. Mm. Because of course the plastic melts a bit more, and you just press a bit more. melt a bit more and you press a bit more until you have an even surface. But I would say, you know, your biggest win there would be the source of plastic. They were super anal about, you know, who is their contractor, who brings them the plastic. And before it even comes in the workspace, they do a huge selection, right? They do small tests, needs to be proper. Only once they prove it on the small machine, they let it into the workspace because they realize that that's the number one factor that sort of makes shit, you know, exceptional or just average.
Ah, cool. And you mentioned those guys are in London who are doing the sheets.
They are from London, but they're in San Jose, Costa Rica.
Oh, Costa Rica. Okay. I'll look those up.
Yeah.
Sounds cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what are the sort of big success stories then from the community who have gone on and done great things? I mean, obviously I know of a few, has there been any like big success stories, people who've grown huge businesses or like what are the, yeah, is there any kind of specific projects that come to mind that we should check out?
Well, there's this project in Bali called Space Available. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah, I've heard about those guys. Yeah, it's pretty cool what they're doing.
They did amazing. No, I would say, yeah, I think there's quite a lot of, really interesting projects that I've actually had the luck myself to meet. So, of course, the robberies, you know them, they're your neighbors.
Project
in Surabaya, Indonesia, they have like maybe 30, 40 people employed, you know, working full time, recycling plastic. They have huge orders. They make quite a decent revenue to be in, you know, in Indonesia. So I would say, and it's run by old women, which is amazing, right, as well. I think it's a perfect story, I would say. And the impact that they are generating is, it's really, you know, impressive, I would say. So after that, I went to Colombia. My wife is Colombian. And there I met Sahu. And this is an organization that bought a fresh plastic machine, bought a mold, and started making sunglasses. And they make really, really cool sunglasses. But these guys, so I think that's the power of precious plastic. These guys are not engineers and not designers. They are phenomenal businessmen. And last year alone, they sold 15,000 sunglasses and they made $500,000 in Colombia, which is a huge amount of money, right? And this year they just, you know, doubled in opening more shops. They opened 3 shops in a year. And this year probably they opened another 5. So, but that really can tell you, you know, you don't need to be an engineer, you don't need to be a designer. You know, you can just have a great idea. Fresh Plastic will provide you all the ecosystem, all the knowledge, all the machines that you need to start, and then you just pull the threads together and then you run your business, right? So I would say that's another, I would say, really cool example from the community. But then I would say even, you know, like just, you know, the one Kenyan guy that is working alone on with an extrusion machine making baskets in, you know, somewhere deep in Kenya. It's amazing, right? Well done. You can dedicate your life to do that and you can make an income out of that. For me, that story is almost more valuable than the $1 million company, right? So, and, you know, we have thousands of those ones and that sort of feeds my heart and gives me energy to work on this every day. And I would say maybe, if you want to know the unicorn $1 million company, you have Plasticpreneur in Austria. They're making machines that are built on top of the precious plastic machines. They've been adjusted and improved. But I think last year they made around $1 million selling these machines. So also very legit business in Europe with much higher cost of, you know, running costs. But still is, you know, it's a viable business also in Europe, as you can see.
Cool, man. So Precious Plastic, 10 years in, been phenomenal success and the impact that you guys have made. So where do you guys go from here then? What's next?
That's $1 million question. Yeah, I think this call comes kind of at a good time. In about 10 days, we turn in 10, which is, you know, kind of a mind-blowing achievement for us. In a way, I guess most startups, they die within a few years. And, you know, given all the difficulties over the past decade, Precious Plastic still is around. It hasn't been an easy ride, I have to admit, but, you know, we're still here and next week we're celebrating 10 years and, you know, it's a massive achievement, I would say, for us, also for the community. We wouldn't be anything without people like you that, you know, take the knowledge and apply them locally. So, yeah, now it's time for celebrating. We're putting out a nice video next week. And we also released in, this is a bit of a secret, but yeah, we're releasing the Precious Plastic Open Source Fund. And the idea is that, you know, Precious Plastic is built on open source knowledge. The idea that, you know, knowledge, when they are free to travel, they can go far and wide, and then they can have a great positive impact. It is within Precious Plastic interest to share open source knowledge. However, you know, for the people that that run the recycling business, sometimes it's kind of, it doesn't make full sense to share that knowledge open source. However, that's super important because, you know, the problem is global, and you know, it's kind of very diverse. You know, place you go, there are different challenges. And I think, you know, having grown this global community, everyone is finding their own small little solutions to the problem where they live, right? So this is a much more holistic way of looking at the problem and the solutions that we create. So I think it's very crucial that people that work on precious plastic, that work on small scale recycling, they also, you know, find a way to share back how they do things, right? So that the community can grow the knowledge base and, you know, learn. Because maybe, you know, if you are somewhere in Venezuela and you found this one way of working with this very specific, you know, plastic coming from the ocean, and you have this solution, this aqua machine, maybe you have someone in the Philippines that also need that, right? And realistically, with a centralized model, it would be much harder to do. So to incentivize people to share their knowledge, we release in the Precious Plastic Open Source Fund with 100,000 euro, which is, you know, really, really great, to enable more open source, you know, sharing more open source knowledge from the community. So we're gonna allow people to pitch their ideas to share their recycling innovation. And I think this is potentially gonna have a big impact, you know, for Precious Plastic and the community. Because I think for us, midterm, you know, what we're working towards is a more decentralized generation of knowledge. So up until now, Precious Plastic was developing all the knowledge, all the machines, all the molds, all the designs, and then we were putting it out there. However, we see this as a not very scalable way to move forward. I think we believe that, you know, if we empower the community to share how they tackle the plastic waste problem, how they improve the machines, how they improve the products, I think this is a way more scalable way approach, right? Where you can have, instead of 5 machines, you can have 20 machines, you can have, you know, hundreds of products, and, you know, and I think it's just more scalable and more a holistic approach, because, you know, realistically, you know, we are just a bunch of people in the Netherlands, in Portugal, wherever. And so our, you know, of course, we are limited in our scope. And I think if we can open it up more for the community, I think we can, reach that larger scale in terms of like the knowledge, because I think that's the key of the project. So, yeah, very excited for that. We're releasing that on the 21st of October.
Oh, amazing.
And, yeah, a little less than 2 weeks. And so that's coming up pretty soon. And next, we just met with a team in Egypt last week. This thing is a bit okay. So we also met with a team last week in Egypt. We are a fully remote team at the moment, so it was very beneficial that we met in one place, you know, and sort of get to know with each other. And the idea of a potential version 5 surfaced a few times, which is both exciting and scary, because the amount of work to develop a version, it's monumental, because every time it's just building on itself, and we just get into you know, a place where, you know, it's really a lot of knowledge, a lot of videos, a lot of documentation. And I think whenever you change, you know, one part, there's a lot of repercussions, right? So that's why it's kind of complex to work and update, you know, Precious Plastic. However, yeah, it looks like we, you know, potentially going to work on a version 5 in the next few years, which is, yeah, very exciting.
Amazing. And where do you see life after plastic then? Have you seen any innovation with materials like that could prove like an alternative? I know there's some biomaterials out there which aren't quite, you know, seen as a like a fully replaceable material yet. Have you seen anything out there in the industry, anything going on that you feel could offer an alternative for the future?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, an alternative needs to tick a lot of boxes, right? Plastic, it's so ubiquitous for a reason. I think, yeah, probably there's not going to be one solution fit them all, but like maybe a multitudes of different materials that can replace plastic in different areas. Of course, biomaterials are good. They're still kind of in their infancy, I believe. There's still a long way to go to meet, you know, the physical capabilities of plastic and what plastic can do. Of course, we run sort of a research project called Beyond Plastic, where we, you know, build a whole library of more biodegradable materials, which you can literally throw in the ocean and they will biodegrade and become food for fish. But, you know, this is, again, version 0.1 of that project. Some interest, some people have replicated the machine, but there's still a very long way to go, I would say, there.
Not totally. I mean, we're experimenting with biomaterials and, you know, there's some great things out there, but it's just not quite, it hasn't quite got the robustness that plastic has. I mean, plastic's actually such a great material. Hence why it's being used so widely. And if you look at the history of plastic, it was actually invented to be a sustainable material of the future. That was like where it started, and that was to combat the ivory trade, which was seen as a big issue back in those days. I guess it was like the climate crisis of the day. We were extracting so many natural resources, and then it was actually a competition. Somebody won a competition from a company who said, if you can come up with an alternative to ivory, you'll win $10,000, which is a lot of money in those days. And somebody did it, and then initially it was a biomaterial, and then it got synthesized. I think it was in 1926 it got synthesized. And then by the 1950s, you know, it became like a single use thing. By the 1970s, it was clear that we had a waste crisis. And then, you know, up to today, where we're living in a plastic planet and we're turning ourselves into plastic people, you know?
Yeah.
So that's
often the case, right? I mean, you know, as an inventor, you think your thing is going to save the world, it's going to change the world, it's going to improve things. I guess no one invents something to make things worse. However, unfortunately, as humanity, we're not very good at looking at the long-term effect of things, you know, which is very immediate as beings. And yeah, only later, 100 years later, you realize, oh God, that thing is actually, you know, causing more problem than it solves. But yeah, you can see that in many aspects, right? I mean, even with the whole AI revolution coming up, I mean, I'm sure these guys don't want to kill the human race, but you know, it's hard to, you know, to predict where that's going to go, for example. So I think it's a kind of a common trait of humans, right? Don't think too much in the future. It looks cool right now, it functions, it solves this problem, this imminent problem right now. Let's just deploy it and see what happens. But it's a dangerous approach.
Yeah, I think it's the human instinct of like having to make progress. You know, I think that's just like what we're built for, is to like survive and thrive and try to get to a place that we don't know where we come from, we don't know where we're going. And I think this like this sort of like ethos of like living in progress and creating technology gets us closer to the source. I think subconsciously we're trying to get closer to the source. But generally with technology, it's fantastic in the short term. But as you said, in the long run, it ends up being a disaster. And when we come up with a solution, it then opens up a different problem in a different place. So it's almost like just moving things around. But if you look at indigenous cultures, how they plan, I think Julia Watson wrote a book called Low Tech, and in the back page it sort of says for the next seven generations. And the reason why it says that is because they plan for seven generations ahead. So if they're building a bridge, they think, okay, how would this bridge serve our, you know, great 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 grandkids 7 years ahead? And they think long term. Whereas in today's society, thinking like, you know, election, 4 years in and out, you know, let's make some money now, let's move there, do this, let's build this as cheaply as possible, move on to the next thing. It's very, very short term. And I think that's definitely a big, big issue in today's world, that we're not thinking long term. So, I totally agree with you on that.
No, I 100% agree. And it's kind of, spinning faster and faster as well, you know, in any aspects, right? Everything is just so short-lived as well. Just look at like all these celebrities and, you know, YouTube stars, and, you know, it's quick and then it goes, and then, you know, you move on to the next thing. But yeah, I think, yeah, more long term would be beneficial for many aspects of our society.
Okay, well, we have hope. You know, we're optimistic. You know, we feel that the future is going to be bright. You know, as you mentioned, recycling certainly isn't the answer to all the problems, but it's a great start. And on that note, you know, I'd like to say thank you to you and the organization. You know, without you guys, we wouldn't be where we are today at Space Available. You know, it means a lot, all the support we've had, you know, using the machines. And yeah, man, keep up the great work. We really appreciate it. And long may Precious Plastic live on and keep making changes. So yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, man. I very much appreciate your work on the ground, and I look closely and the work that you do. I'm also always on a hand for one of your shirts, which always looks amazing.
I'll have to send you some new shirts over. We've got some new ones. Yeah.
They look amazing. You guys are really leading on that, and, you know, on the whole innovation. I think, you know, you guys are really, you know, continuing the work that we set out 10 years ago, right? You were saying that you were in Eindhoven 2017 in this exhibition. You know, we did that. We did, you know, all this, you know, partnership with like luxury brands and so on. You know, and now it's over to you. You guys are taking it on, and, you know, like you do in Bali, there's people doing it around the world. So I think it's, you know, it's amazing how, you know, we are entering society and sort of, you know, in this decentralized manner and sort of really scaling the impact together as a movement. So thank you very much for your work, man. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, man. And we hope to see you in Bali again soon, yeah?
Yes, man. I really hope I can make it there soon.
Cool. Excellent. All right, well, I'll let you get back to your plastic, precious plastic machines. Keep on recycling, and we'll speak again very soon.
100%, man. Have a good day.
Yeah, great to speak to you, man. Thanks so much. Cheers.
Ciao.